Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 13, lucky number 13, of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer. And we are in love with all things Outlander. So some people think 13s are bad luck. I happen to disagree. I think I used to think that 13s were bad luck. Because, you know, everyone talks about 13s.
What's that word for fear of 13s? Or fear of the 13th or something like that?
It is, in fact, triskaidekaphobia. I think I heard it on a commercial on the radio once. And it's
beautiful stuck. Greek word roots.
But I used to think that 13s were bad luck. And then my daughter was born on Friday the 13th of all days. And now I think that they can't be all that bad.
No, and I never had a true fear or a true disliking of Friday the 13th. Definitely because of our culture or because of the way it's those movies that were made and the way it's portrayed in media, in movies and everything. I'm sure I absorbed some of that growing up and had some feelings that were similar to that, but I've never been afraid or superstitious about the day.
So 13s, not so bad.
No, not really.
And I think that especially that counts for the Outlander podcast. I think this is actually very special. A very special 13th episode.
Unplanned. The number was completely unplanned.
Coincidental.
Very coincidental.
But a happy coincidence. But before we get into that, we can talk about our announcements. It'll be brief. We won't keep you that far from Davina. We had very little going on this week, so the announcements should be quite short. So we did get one new picture from Outlander Stars on their Instagram account, which I actually really enjoyed this picture. It was a view from behind the camera, so what
it was behind the person behind the camera. Correct. So it was really cool to see.
And the scene they were filming was what looked like a World War II flashback, which is very exciting. I like that time period. And I thought that the costumes looked amazing. Mm.
Yeah, it was very it was nice. Okay. I was happy to see it too. It was because I'm pretty sure we're not going to be seeing that type a photo, like a photo from behind the vantage point of behind the camera. I just don't see how we'll see that before the show airs from the 18th century period filming. But it was great that they could show us some subject matter from that vantage point that wouldn't be any kind of spoiler. Because you know the time frame the show starts in. We know where some of the flashbacks are going to be from. So there's no surprise, no spoiler that there was a war. No, in the 40s.
And it was all extras. It all appeared to be, you know, extras or day players. So it wasn't any of the stars of the show. So
that we know, yeah.
That we've been introduced to. Yeah. Yeah. It was a nice little picture. Speaking of pictures, I think he's a producer, Matt B. Roberts. Mm-hmm. He's on his Twitter account. He's become quite prolific in his picks of the day.
I like his shots.
And most of them are not show related. But we are totally okay with that. We love pictures of Scotland, period.
Doesn't matter where. Have you seen our Facebook page? A lot of those shots that we have saying, good night, Outlanders, or sleep tight, or whatever it may be, those have nothing to do with the show. But those are just, in my opinion, gorgeous shots from different areas. I do try and typically get a nighttime or a moonlit shot, but just gorgeous photos we've shared. So absolutely, anything with Scotland, we're happy.
We're pretty easy to please here. But he had a great shot that I think was my favorite one that he's done in the last couple weeks. It was a shot, it was foggy, and it was in the woods, and it was like the backs of like two horses in the background with all this fog and mist. I thought that was just, the composition was really well done. It was pretty. We do have a new production member who's joined Twitter. His name is John Gary Steele. He's the production designer for the series.
And thank you so much, Ms. Terry Fanning, for twisting his arm in your friendly way. I believe that they've been friends for quite a while. And she was able to, if not get him on Twitter.
Coerce.
I don't want to coerce. Help us have him on Twitter. In whatever way she was involved with that. We're very thankful because, again, it's another incredible knowledge base that we have access to, which I've never been such a fangirl for any other production, don't get me wrong, But I've never seen another production, again, in its ramping up period, in its production period, be so open and giving and sharing whatever with the fans.
Well, that's something that I think has been quite unique mm-hmm. to this whole experience, is that how open they've been with the fans and provided us with so much behind the scenes kind of information ahead of time, and not how involved they let us be, but I mean, there is a level of involvement and interaction that most production series, I don't think that you would have that.
Well, I think you're probably right. I think you also have to look at what is the fan base like before or while something is in production. There are movies made all the time that are adaptations from books, and they have large fan bases. They may not be as as involved or as opinionated as the Outlander fans, as Outlanders are. I don't know. I think it was just a magical, if you want to use that word, a very serendipitous combination of the fans, the author, the production team. It is this combination that I think that's the only way we can explain it. They would not be so open and sharing and excited, I think, if that fan base were not there. Because without the fan base, this would not probably have come to this. We did not cause it, but because everything is coming together, a great, wonderful, talented, giving author, very communicative with fans, and thus that kind of feeds the fans, we love that she communicates. And that has now translated over into a lot of the production team and a good number of leads.
So if you're interested in looking up Mr. Steele, his Twitter account is at J-O-N Gary Steele with an E on the end. And I guess lastly, the last thing I could think of that happened this week is the video of the interview at the BAFTAs. Because I know we all got the written interview.
Yes.
Last week, right after the BAFTAs, that was put up online that we all read and enjoyed. And then Monday, I believe it was Monday, they posted the video of that interview, which I don't know about you guys, but I'm just so excited to see him moving in a picture. And
and not, it was such, not a still.
It was such a relief to be able to see him talking and have him talking with a Scottish accent and just how
congenial
he is. I don't know. He just seems like a really nice guy, which makes me happy.
Just everyone that we've seen in their carriage and in their communication with fans, with each other, that we've been allowed to see, has been very friendly and cordial.
I think, though, he's going to need to start wearing a pin of some kind that says, you know, I wear my kilt like a Scots, because...
Or just, I'm a true Scotsman. That's
right,
it. Because
I think that everyone, he's going to be hearing that question a lot, like between now and forever, basically.
Now,
because everyone thinks they're so clever when they ask it, and you know, it's like everyone's heard it 1,000 times, and so it's like it's going to be like the running gag of his interviews, I guarantee you. And he goes anywhere in a kilt, someone is going to ask him.
I think anyone who wears a kilt is not open and wanting that question, but opening themselves up. I'm not saying it should be like this, but it's people think maybe they're original when they ask that question.
Well, it's like, it would be like people making fun of my name because it's summer and they call me Autumn, or they, you know, yeah, say, see you next fall, or they say something silly that's like seasonally related, thinking that it's going to be the first time I've ever heard that
joke. Oh yeah, believe me, I almost said as a ginger. I am not a ginger. Well, I guess I am a ginger. I'm just not a ginger. Anyway, I've heard, where's Fred? Where's Marianne? Ginger Snaps? I mean, come on. Yeah, I've heard it all.
Well, that, and how many people did we know growing up that had dogs named Ginger?
I remember hearing, like, in eighth grade or something, that the number one name for dogs was Ginger, and I was just somehow not amused.
Well, you either got, what, stripper?
Excuse me?
Isn't, like, Ginger, like, a stripper name?
Oh, well,
excuse me? Oh my god, the outrage.
I don't...
Outrage!
I have nothing against strippers, but I've never... I don't consort with strippers, so I don't know. I've never asked them.
She's very innocent.
Hey, now.
Anywho. So last week, we had the pleasure of speaking to Miss Davina Porter. She was so gracious in setting aside some time to speak with us, and she was just very open, and I don't think there was a single question we asked her that she wasn't willing to answer.
We didn't ask her any risque things. Of course come not. On.
I mean, I wouldn't ask her the questions I'd ask you, but
hey.
Well, I guess we've prattled on long enough. We'll get you guys to what you really want to hear.
The lovely Ms. Davina Porter.
It wasn't a very likely place for disappearances, at least first glance. Mrs. Baird's was like 1,000 other Highland bed and breakfast establishments in 1945. Clean and quiet, with fading floral wallpaper, gleaming floors, and a coin-operated hot water geyser in the lavatory. Mrs. Baird herself was squat and easygoing, and made no objection to Frank lining her tiny rose-sprigged parlour with the dozens of books and papers with which she always travelled.
So I'm sure you all recognize that voice. That is the first time that most of us were introduced to Miss Davina Porter. The first 30 seconds or so that we got introduced to the voice that is Davina Porter. And re-listening to that now, I mean, it brings back such emotion from reading listening to the first book by her. So we were very thrilled that she agreed to take some time away from one of her weekends and spend it with us.
Thank you so much. This has been we're very, very, very excited to have the opportunity. You've been very gracious to spend some of your weekend time with us.
Not a problem. Having recorded not just Diana, and I'm waiting with great anticipation for the latest one, and I've read a lot of other authors, and she's up there among the top. So anyway, yeah.
That is nothing less than what I would most likely expect to hear from someone who performed her wonderful mm-hmm. series. And mm-hmm. She's incredible to read. I couldn't imagine. Actually, we have a question coming up about your prep specific to her, if indeed there is anything. So we will come to that. How did you get started as a voice artist?
Well, I'm an actress and was looking at a copy of Backstage, which gives you all the auditions in the New York area plus other parts of the country. And tucked right away at the back was wanted narrator to record Culloden. And Culloden said it's actually a history, and it was the last battle between the English and the Scots. And it was the Bonnie Prince Charlie who was defeated, and the Highlanders. That was the beginning of the clearances. Anyway, by one John Preble. And I thought, well, my mother is a Scot. I'm married to a Scot. I'm not a native-born Scot, but I think I can certainly do the pronunciations. So off I trotted and auditioned for them. And at that stage in my career, before really recorded books had even taken off, I sat at my kitchen table with a tiny little tape recorder and sent off a tape. That was how kind of archaic it was. So I trotted up to New York and had an audition. And then she said to me, well, I like your voice very much, but we really need a male. So thank you. And I came home and I said to Gus, it's a question of thank you, but no thank you. However, about 3 months later, Claudia called me again and she said, was I still interested? And I said, well, what happened to all the native-born Scots? She said we had dozens of tapes, and they were all totally incomprehensible.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Wow.
So that's how I started. This was quite some years ago, and then my main company is still Recorded Books, but I have recorded for other folk. And that's how it started. And started off with a Scottish history, and at that time we were only recording, there were two companies, one in California and one here in the New York area, and they were doing unabridged classics. So I did Madame Bovary and Anna Karenina and The Red and the Black and Tessa the D'Urbervilles, and the classics to listen to are absolutely fabulous. And having been forced, if you like, to do them at school, it's a whole different ball game when you read them out loud. It really is. And then after that, they got a library contract, so we went into bestsellers, and that also came. If you had a bestseller of one author, then there would be many other books by the same author that they felt were worth recording. So that's how it started. And now it's a huge industry. The audiobook industry has really grown since I started with it all these years ago. So that's how I became a narrator.
We actually wanted to ask you just a little bit about your beginning as and the development as an actress as well. You began as an actress. Did you receive training? Did you study?
No. Always acted at school. I was born in the UK, as you can tell, and started off just school productions and realized I loved it. At the time when I was ready to go to college, my mother said, well, if you become an actress, you may not make it. So she said, get another career first. So I trained as a teacher and became a teacher and then realized I really enjoyed teaching, but kept acting as a sideline. And now we fast forward to when I met my husband and we emigrated to the States. And it was an easy way of getting in to the local community. We moved around an awful lot initially. And I looked for a community theater because then you could find different people from all walks of life. I could act and I could meet other than mothers at the school with the children or company wives, which were not always sort of good friendships. And then that took me into professional. I got my equity card and became a quote professional actress and felt I would never act again because suddenly, you know, it's a whole different ballgame. You've got all these very good actresses all out there competing for the same parts. So the book narration was always... It came from acting because you are looking at characters, you can develop the voices, you can decide how you want them to sound, always bearing in mind you are the conduit for the author. You can't put your own spin on the character because they have to follow the course that he or she has set out for them. But you can have fun with them. And you also have complete power. You're not waiting for someone to give you a cue. You're not out there thinking, oh my word, I've forgotten my line. You are there in control of the whole book, and it's a great feeling. Plus, it's so enjoyable. I mean, I love narrating books. I used to love acting, too. I do still act, but not as much as I used to.
Connected to what you just said, do you have a lot of contact with authors? So when you, especially maybe when it's a new author and you get a work that you are preparing to go into the studio with from an author that you have not read before, do you have contact with authors about character choice?
Not really. Some of my fellow narrators do. I met Diana. We were in Gainesville, Florida. And that we were doing a fundraiser. And I was asked to join her, and I was able to read a little chunk of the unpublished Breath of Snow and Ashes. And that's when I met her. I also have met another author, Alexander McCall Smith, which is the Sunday Philosophers Club group, again, set in Scotland. So it really helps to be married to a Scot. I've listened to the accent for so long. yes, I know those two, but I read many, many other authors and I've never met them. Occasionally, I will talk to them, if you like, through the publisher. But mainly, we are chosen by, I'd like to think sometimes an author will request you, but very often it's more the producer and with recorded books. The actors and the actresses there, we nearly are all actors and actresses, are chosen for their suitability. I mean, obviously, I will do English authors. Some of the American books I would love to record, but why? Because I'm so very British when you've got so many good other American actors. So couldn't do, for example, Moby Dick. It has to be a man in New England. Would love to do To Kill a Mockingbird, but I've got to be a 12-year-old southern child. So, yeah. So there is, that's how they choose. So the authors, I don't know if they ever request you. I did have one, but I don't think her book was ever picked up. So, no. And I know another friend of mine was on very good terms with one of her authors. But it's more business-like, I think. You know, it comes... The author goes to the publisher either gives it to a publishing company or rather a recording company, Baroque Self Records. A lot of Random House now, I think, do their own recording, whereas before they used to farm it out to independent producers, because it's got so huge. When I started, I could tell you, books on tape, recorded books. Now there must be dozens and maybe even hundreds of companies out there, some of whom employ me and some of whom don't, and they really should.
Well, speaking of employment, and since you have had such an illustrious career that we hope goes on for 50 more years.
I would hope. Yes.
We all would hope. Are you still in the position where you must audition?
Yes, believe it or not. I did audition. It's been a couple of years now, and I had forgotten that I had auditioned. Yes, I have actually had to sit down and read a chunk of the author's book, and they send it to, this was a lady this time, and I never knew who got it, but she didn't like my voice. Originally, she had wanted to record it herself, and some writers are excellent. Stephen King is one who can narrate his own books, but there are some who really shouldn't, and I think this particular writer was suggested that perhaps she needed a voice who sounded more like her but wasn't her. And I didn't sound like her, so I didn't get the job. So the voice in her head wasn't mine, and that makes a difference. And I sometimes wonder, when you've written a book and you are so close to those characters and you hear someone like me who obviously is reading it from a different aspect, and you think, I didn't think they were going to sound like that. That's not the idea of how I thought that character should be. And you sometimes wonder, are they happy with it, or are they saying, oh, no, 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 no. And I've never been able to say to someone, well, is that what you had in mind when you wrote the book? Is this the voice you had in your head? So.
Well, for so many of us, you are the voice of Claire.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that going into this new series that Starz is creating, we are expecting Katrina to sound like you.
Yeah. Yes. I'm very interested. I can't wait to see. And visually, I have a very strong visual picture of Claire and Jeannie. And these actors are going to have to measure up to that. And all the characters. I mean, when we go back to the very first one with Dougal and all these folks, and later on with Ian and Brianna. And I know it's Brianna, but I think Jamie called her Brianna. There's all these, little Jimmy and the chick. So I can't wait to see how they do that. And will it be one of these actually following the books, which they should do, or was it based on the characters of, which always, sometimes you think, oh dear, that's, I hope that's not going to be disappointing. However, we'll see. It's been a long time in the coming, because I know they've been talking about doing a series for years. So, and is it HBO going to do it? I can't remember.
Stars,
that's right. Yeah. So, yeah, can't wait to see what happens there.
So, when you first get a book or a manuscript or a file, what condition is it in? I seem to remember an interview you did with Ageless TV, and you were mentioning how you prefer to get the whole thing, but sometimes it comes to you in chunks, especially nowadays, the way they do it.
Yeah, you should. You must get the whole thing, because if you don't, the author will give clues all the way through of how a character is. Obviously, if it's a crime, you've got to be very careful not sort of say, oh, aha, I know this is the villain, and I'm going to make him the villain. But I did record one book years and years ago, and I'd done a number for this particular writer, and I got lazy. And I did a particular character who was the old maiden aunt. So I gave her a very elderly voice. She didn't have much of a part in the book, but about three pages from the end, she replied in her low, melodious voice, her one true beauty. And that jumped off the page. And I have recorded the whole character as a high, querulous, rather, you know, elderly lady speaking these things. And I thought, Davina, always, always read the book. Because the author will throw, you know, a sort of a looped ball at the end. And again, it's not fair. Well, backtracking, I do have a narrator who really surprised me. He said, oh, I never read the book. Because it's like when I read a book for the first time, that's how I want my listeners to hear it. And I thought, but you can't. You're doing a disservice to your listener. Because what happens with the aha moment at the end, which you have led up to, knowing the aha moment is coming, but you should know it before it surprises you. Because they do, they can twist the plot, they can twist a character, they can totally change a character, and you must know, as the narrator, what's going to happen. Because I think otherwise you do a great disservice to the author and to the listener.
Well, because the reader is more like the guide. You're supposed to be guiding your listeners through this book, and if you don't have
exactly.
a guide...
Exactly. Well, you can't if you're leading them blind. If you haven't... exactly. If you've been lazy enough... Anyway, there are three main reasons. A, you read the story first. At least I read the story first. I read the whole thing. And at the same time, I underline words which I have often read but never actually said. Now, is it harassment or is it harassment? Is this an English book? Is it an English person speaking? Is it controversy? Warwick in Rhode Island, Warwick in England. So, A, you must get your pronunciations right. I did Thorn Birds, and I think there's a Galah bird, not a Gullah bird, a Galah. And any native-born Australian will wince if you say it wrongly. So that's your first thing. Look at your words. Do I know how to say them? Then I make a list of characters, and if I can get a pencil sketch from the writer, how old is this person? Are they secure? Are they timid? Are they aggressive? Are they mean? So you do little pencil notes, and then you can say to yourself, okay, this character comes in once. I can have fun with this person. I can maybe do a voice, but I wouldn't do it all the way through the book. It would become tiresome. So you make these choices, but you've got to read the book first to do those. And then before I go in and record, I reread. Let's say I know it's a short session, so I'll maybe only do 100 pages. So reread those 100. So you can keep going, because in the studio, time is money. They don't want you forever going back and forever making mistakes. And for goodness sake, once you've got a pronunciation of a person's name, make sure it's consistent all the way through. Because there are a few names out there that can be pronounced a couple of ways, you know, like Megan or Megan. So don't become Megan halfway through when you said Megan from the very beginning. So, yeah, there's a lot of homework before you sit down and record a book. There really is.
I would assume it would depend on the length, number one, but also whether or not it's, say, part of a series such as the upcoming Diana Gabaldon book. You've
yeah.
recorded the other seven, so
yes.
you still put your time into it, but the prep might be slightly different because it's not from the ground up. It's from the ground up because it's a new manuscript, but not from the ground up because it will have characters you are already familiar with.
Yes.
So,
and you have to remember what voice you gave. I do have notebooks. I don't actually record the voices. I think when Jim Dale did the Harry Potter series, he actually has a sound file. But I know how Jamie sounds. I know how Claire sounds. I know the main characters. That I will sometimes go back into my notebooks and think, oh, this is now Jamie's sister. I haven't actually recorded her for the last three or four books. So you have to go back and decide what you had done. You do a little note to self. And so, yeah, the main characters you keep in your head, and then any new characters, not a problem. But you have to go through the text carefully to see where they come from. Are these time travelers? Are they modern? The plus about when she sets everything in America, there was no, quote, American accent then. Because they were all immigrants. So you have the Germans and the French and the Brits and the English and the Scots. And so there was no, quote, you know, New York accent, Southern accent, Far West. So I can fudge that. Believe it or not, after living in the States all these years, I cannot do a good American accent. Not one that American won't sort of wince and look away.
So I just
hope that she doesn't set it wholly in the States. But I think they were heading to Canada, so that's okay too. Again, that was immigrants, so mainly French. And goodness only knows what Indians, or I should say Native Americans, sounded when they were speaking English.
Yeah. Exactly, as non-native English speakers, unless they were schooled by went to the church school or a mission priest,
yes,
or something.
Yeah, if they went to the priest school, they would learn that. But then, of course, it was a Catholic, it would probably be Spanish or French. So would they be speaking English with a French accent, because that's how they had learned it?
Exactly.
So many
choices. Oh my goodness.
I know. Too many choices.
Too many choices.
You don't want to spoil the narration. You don't want to have the narrative spoiled by, what did she say? I didn't hear that. So you have to be careful when you are doing a dialect, not to be too strong, not to be too correct, because it can disturb you. If you really go into a Mancunian or a Hampshire accent that's really thick, people are just going to say, I have no idea what she said. And that will turn them off the narrative, and you don't ever want that.
So once you've got your manuscript and you're prepared, and you are taking, you are traveling into the city, and
right,
you're going to do a normal full day at a studio. What is that typical day like? How long?
I usually start at 8:30. And I record, I'm better in the morning. I am a morning person. So 8:30 to, let's say, 10:30, and a quick break, which is either water, green apples are great because it takes a scratch out of your voice. And then I will record again until lunch, take a 20-minute break for lunch, and hopefully go on till about 4. And by that time, you are really, once you start pushing, once you feel your voice is getting a little bit labored, you think, stop, there's no point. You don't want to sound tired. Because hopefully, when I pick up the next day or the next, maybe 2 days later, it's the same volume and it's the same energy. You must be consistent through the book. So my working day is usually, certainly with Diana's new book coming up, it will be from 8:30 to 4. Hopefully, I will have a day off, but the last one, I just had to go in for about 2 weeks to just get it done. Because as we're recording, it's being proofed so that it's coming out at the same time we're publishing it. Let's say whatever day in March it is. Both are released, the audio and the hardback, and the hardcover. When I first did her books, or when I first did Outlander, it had been out for a year or two. So I had the luxury of taking my time to record it. But now new books and new audios come out at the very same time, which can be hard when the writer maybe hasn't quite finished the manuscript or is still tweaking. And I have done new manuscripts, finished them, and then I have to go back where there's been rewrites and slight changes. And those are the retakes, and that's fine. But you sometimes feel, I wish I'd known that before I recorded the book. That's up to the author, and I understand Diana is a whiz when she says, right, clear the deck, I'm going to finish this book. So I should have it in good time. So, yeah, so normally, as I say, 8:30 with a couple of breaks till around 4, and then I go home.
I ask this question simply because this is for me, and may hope it interests others. You mentioned for your short breaks or even your lunch break, you say an apple is a good snack to help clear your throat and take away the scratchiness. Are there foods that you avoid while you're recording or days before?
Yeah. Tea with honey is always good. And I think it's a lemon zinger or something with honey in it. That's also very soothing. Yeah, you cannot eat too much, because then your stomach gurgles. Coffee is very, very bad, and I love coffee. But coffee dries your throat, and it also gives you a stomach gurgle. So I eat lightly, and nothing like that's very fibrous. just because the microphone is so sensitive. And that's the same with clothing. You dress, can't wear silk because it rustles and cotton crackles and leather creaks. So you have to really be very careful what you wear when you go in. So just loose, comfortable clothing that rides with you. I mean, wool is good. That doesn't do anything. And food that is just going to quietly digest itself. Because otherwise, periodically, you have to say, I'm so sorry, I'm going to have to go out and stretch. Or drop to my knees. I've done that before now, is drop to my knees and stretch so the diaphragm is stretched. So I'm talking into the microphone. I'm still at the same level, but I'm actually kneeling, which gets a bit uncomfortable, but it keeps the stomach from gurgling and any extraneous noises. So, which if you've got a good engineer the other side, we'll say, hey, we've got to go back and redo that. So, yeah. So food is important. You can't, and also if you eat too much, you're going to get soporific, and it's going to be even harder to record in the afternoon. So,
I always find these little tidbits very interesting because people, including myself, don't always think about what goes into it other than the voice.
And yeah, no, yeah. It's quite a discipline because you learn, you have to sit still for a very long time. And you really, the actual recording is lovely. I don't have to speak any more loudly than I am to you. But you are speaking out loud. You must control your breathing because nobody wants every other sentence. You also don't want to find you running out of breath at the end of a sentence. You know, it's got to be the same level and the same energy. And you must finish a book at the same energetic level you started with. So recorded books, certainly, and over the years I've also practiced this, I may deliberately stop 30 pages before the end of a book, which I could finish. I would rather come in fresh the next day and finish on a high so that you don't go down on the home note and it's almost, oh, thank goodness, this book is over because I'm exhausted. So you always do the latter, even as I say, if it's only 30 pages, you do that on a separate recording session to keep the energy up. But I like to think that if you listen to one of my recordings, you don't know where I stop for the day. You shouldn't know where I stop for the day. You shouldn't be able to say, oh, she's got tired here. The voice has gone down and the energy is gone. But yeah, I do love it. I really do. I hope I can continue to record until they're wheeling me in and out of the studio. But that's the one plus with acting. It's such a youth-oriented art. And once you get into the character actors, that's fine too. But then you can get younger people doing character acting. But recording, it doesn't matter. As long as your voice holds out and you hope that listening, how old is she? It doesn't really matter. I had a very nice article once written in the New York Times of one of the journalists who listened to and from work. And she said, I never want to meet Davina Porter. I never want to put a face to the voice. That way I can lose myself in the book. But she said, I don't need to know the age of the person recording. And I thought that was very neat, actually. So, and I think she's got a good point. Because I will tell you a little story. A very, very good friend of mine reads a lot of romantic novels. And does them extremely well. Well, when the author came in, she said, Oh my goodness, you're far too old to be reading that. Oh, I don't like that. I thought, but it doesn't matter. His voice is youthful. His voice makes you think of all the hot-blooded young blades that you get in the romantic novels. So what does his face matter? So anyway, so I'm glad that this woman never wanted to meet me in case I spoil her listening to my books from now on. So.
Is there a specific genre you prefer over any other when you record? Or?
No. I think Sanskrit, a well-written book. I've recorded some really cracking detective novels, which have been quite gruesome. But they were page-turners. They raced. I've also recorded some rather dear books. They call them cozies, and they are detective novels that are more like the Agatha Christies, or the ones that, that take place in the little English villages. And the murders are not very grotesque, and they're always done by deduction, not by police work, so that you can read them on the beach or curled up in front of the fire and enjoy a good read. But no, I haven't actually met a book that I didn't care for. I read a very, very, recorded a very good book on the life of Montaigne. I love reading histories, too. I've done a couple of Barbara Tuchmans. So as long as the writer is good, I will read anything. One of my most favorite books was last year, a children's book called Shadows and Goons, which was set in London, Victorian London. It's an American writer. She'd really done her homework on the morals and the mores of Victorians and their obsession with death. And it was, there was magic in it, and it was so well written. And children's books, for the most part, are extremely well written because there are no contractions. You don't say can't. You always say cannot. In a regular adult book, you can contract. Even if the writer says, I cannot do this, you say, I can't do this, just to move it along. Not with children's books. Grammatically, they are usually perfect, and you read every word as it is written. There's no contractions at all. So, yeah, I don't think I have a favorite genre. Good book, good author. I'm very happy.
Have you ever read a book that you did not care for that you did the recording for?
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
no name, no type rule. That's when your skill comes in. I have read some books, and I thought, I even wonder how they're published. But someone out there likes them, and that's the person you read to. And you're not there to judge. You are there to do your best with the writer's intent and to tell a good story. And it doesn't matter. Even if you end up wanting to bang your head on the wall, you think, no, I will do my best with a book that I don't care for as with a book that I do care for. So, yeah, I give them the same, the same concentration. If I really, really don't like the book, I have rejected one. But you don't want to do that too often because there's too many of us out there and you don't want to be thought difficult. And as I say, somebody out there, the fact the book is published, the fact the writer has a following, somebody out there likes the stuff, so therefore read to them.
In a typical year, how many books might you record?
It really depends. I don't have a contract per se. The last year I had a phenomenal year. This year, not so many. I was in England for a couple of months. So you sort of break the flow, if you like. Then I had surgery and I had recovered from that. So I'm on a sort of a hiatus at the moment. But I'm really waiting for Diana's book to come out. And then next year, in the spring, there will be more. I think at one particular year, my good year, I probably did about 14, 15 books that year. Again, it really depends on the size of them, because some of them are huge. I just done an Elizabeth George, and that was 430 pages. But these cozies I was telling you about are around 300. And there's not that many words on a page. So even a 300-page book would not be as tightly written as, say, another novel, a longer novel, which may have 430 pages but has far many more words on a page. So it's actually even longer than the 430 pages would sound.
When you're researching, so when you're reading your book, I know that you said that it takes about 2 weeks to record a Diana book.
Yeah, but that's really intense because she usually does the 900 pages.
Right.
But the plus about her, she's a very easy, she's a wonderful writer, and she's a very easy writer to narrate. And I got into her style because every writer has their own style, and after a while you get into a rhythm, and you know how to do the narrative, and the narrative just flows. So you just have to give more credence to how many characters she's got, because, boy, she bungs a lot of characters in her book. She really does, which is another reason, I think, as to why he's successful. Because she has these quirky little, not little characters, but she, each character has a definite, a personality. So, but once you get into the rhythm of her writing, or any author's writing, then you can record more easily.
Do you find that, does it take you as long to read it, to prepare it, as it does for you to record it?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I don't really mark my hours on preparation. Usually in the studio, you expect to get one finished hour for every 2 hours. I think I am better than that now because I've been doing it for a fair time. But you've still got to read it very carefully. So you still, as I say, the first time I read, it's more of a speed read. You skim through, and the part about having the manuscript on paper, you can mark it up. I hate marking up a book. I feel that's a different thing. But, of course, when you're working with a new book, you haven't got a book, but you are working with a manuscript with the paper. Fine. I don't know. I would say probably it takes me longer to prepare it than it does to read it. Because there's so much you have to underline and go back and either do your own research or send it to someone who will help you. For example, the very first Outlander, an awful lot of Gaelic. Now, I don't speak Gaelic, and my husband doesn't. The first person we approached was our best man, who had a friend who was a Gaelic speaker. But then I found a wonderful man from South East who lived in New Hampshire. So I would write down all the Gaelic words, send them to him, and he would record them on a tape and send them back to me. So that took a lot of research. Well, she hasn't got so much in her books now, but initially there was an immense amount, which is good because it set the scene. So, I would say probably I spend more time doing the research and reading the book than I do actually recording it. Because by that time, it's familiar. It's like when you go into an exam, you're prepared.
That makes sense. Makes sense. I know that I take way more than 2 weeks to read a Diana novel.
Oh, yes.
They're so lengthy and you don't want to miss it.
Yeah. And it's a different technique. Almost when I'm I wouldn't say I'm not reading it, but it's different. I approach the book differently because you are narrating it. And when you read it, you can put it down and you can say, oh, I'm going to go back and redo that again. And now who is this character? Let me flip back and find out. You've only got one stab at it when you're recording. And so you can't rush it. It's got to be there. And so, but by that time, as I say, having read the book probably 3 times by the time I'm in sitting down recording, because by the time you've done the first read, then done the second read to really make sure you've got everything. And then before I go into the studio, I prepare what I'm going to record that day. And at the end of the day, the evening is spent preparing for the next day. So I've always got what I'm going to record is very fresh in your head. And even then, you know, you suddenly think, oh, I missed that sentence. It's funny what the brain does. And sometimes, good as a lot of writers are, they do make mistakes grammatically or sentence construction. And you will correct that without thinking about it. And we, as narrators, are supposed to record exactly what is in front of us. So if the proofer hasn't done a very good job, we'll have to say, do I do this as it is written or can I make it correct? And that sometimes goes back to the publishers who say, sure, correct it, or no, that's what she wanted. It's a deliberate mistake, keep it. So what you hear is exactly what's in the book, if you were listening and reading at the same time.
So one of the jobs of a good actor is to bring the story to life and to bring the intended emotion to the audience. Mm-hmm. And so the audience can experience it, hopefully, the way the playwright or the author meant it. The same for the voice actor or the narrator. Mm-hmm. So when you come across, in whichever book, when you come across an extremely emotional or a scene that just guts you?
Well, emotion is a fine line, because if you really let rip, which you can on stage, it can be very jarring listening. So I tend to play emotionally tighter and more controlled, and you can do it, and you can still get the emotion across with almost less is more. I don't mean flat, I mean intensity. Because sometimes you will have a character actually crying. Now, you really cannot cry. It could become very theatrical, particularly if you're driving on the freeway. I mean, a lot of folk listen to books when they're driving. So you don't need an outpouring, but you can play it with suppressed emotion and make it very, very effective. And the same with any strong emotion, disgust, anger, fear, underplay, but play it intensely. And it works. It's a different technique. I mean, as I say, acting, you can let rip, particularly if you're feeding off the energy of the audience and off your fellow actors, but it's just you in the booth. So you have to be careful. I did it very well. Again, it was Diana in her first book, a very good sex scene. And I thought, I've never read a sex scene. Is it going to come across stilted? Am I going to be, you know, stiff upper lip English? It's going to sound ridiculous. So I did my best. And I didn't even want to look at the monitor. It was a very good friend of mine who I've got. She does all the recordings with me. And I thought, I hope she doesn't look at me and say, oh, that was terrible, Davina. And all she did, she smoked. She handed me a cigarette as I walked out of the booth. I said, oh, I guess that worked then. She said, oh, yes.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, my
God. So I thought, well, that's fine. But it was very good. And anyway, so, yeah, I would say, again, with any suppressed, any emotion, less is more, really.
Okay, how about a little bit about your own, the theater company you are involved with?
Well, there's a little theater here, and I don't do so much acting now. I'm going to be doing a couple of stage readings, which I love, and those are in the libraries. And sometimes we will take them to, you know, senior citizens' homes and things like that. But there's a couple. I used to do a fair bit in Boston, and I used to do a fair bit in New York. Not Broadway, alas, but the little theatres, there are a plethora there. But mainly now I concentrate on book narration, just because it's a lot easier, and I don't have the drudgery, and it is a drudgery to learn lines now. I used to be able to just do them through rehearsal. But the acting is almost a sideline now, and I'm much more, I would describe myself now as a narrator rather than an actress.
One of the most heartbreaking scenes that I have read and heard you narrate in all of Diana's books probably has to be the one in A Breath of Snow and Ashes, mm-hmm. where Roger and the men come upon the family in the woods.
Mm.
And Roger finds the little girl who is almost dead.
Mm.
And I understand that they are Diana's words, but you bring them you describe such a difficult, painful, ugly scenario with grace and beauty, if that's possible to say. And the description, your tone, using her words, is one of the most heartbreaking scenes I've ever listened to. And I have to guess that, among other things, that is why you won the 2006 Audie Award for that novel.
Well, thank you very much. That's very nice. Yeah, it was heartbreaking. And I was imagining, you know, my children are all well grown now, but you just put yourself into thinking, would this be me? Would this be you can always pull something out of a family remembrance or just thinking of something that's moved you very deeply. And again, I just read it and reread it, and I thought, yes, I know how I'm going to do this. And again, once you get into her style, she manages to change emotions easily for the narrator. It's almost like she's writing her books to be read out loud. I'm sure she doesn't do that deliberately, but that's what I feel as I'm recording them now. She's a joy to record. She really is. As I say, her writing skills and her storytelling is absolutely fabulous. So it's easy to read. Another one, much on a less traumatic moment, was when Claire has to let her cat go, and she bursts into tears. And Claire is a very strong woman and a very grounded woman, and she just cries. And I could feel for that too. And she said, it's so silly, it's just a cat. But it's the same thing. And sometimes when I'm reading, again, when I recorded that, and that was a bit I actually had to read in front of the ladies at Gainsborough, and I thought, Gainsborough's rather, and I thought, I'm going to cry. And you mustn't cry. You know, you can't stand up there in front of a group of ladies when you're reading from a lectern and then just burst into tears. And I found that one of the hardest things ever to record, because you almost can disassociate yourself from man's inhumanity to man. You have to survive. But when it's a pet and when it's a cat, and a cat is going all unknowing, and that brought it home, just what Claire was giving up when they were moving on. But she's just such a great storyteller, and the emotions are very easy to portray there. But again, less is more. Yeah, I can't wait to see what she's going to do with this next book, really.
We're very excited. We all can't wait. I think they pushed back the publication date to June, so you may have more time to prepare the next book.
Oh, thank goodness. So I think I'm off the hook for December then. They told me I'd start in December. Well, it's now November, what is it, the 16th, 17th? And I haven't had a piece of the manuscript. Now, you don't just jump in with her books. You've got to read them. And you've got to prepare them. So, that is a relief.
So, do you ever have any, like, blooper reels from when you're recording?
I'm sorry?
Like bloopers, like a gag reel, like mistakes you make, like outtakes?
Oh, bloopers. We used to do that. We used to have a big Christmas party, well, we still do, and they would have these outtakes and bloopers. And then they found the engineers, now called directors actually, but the engineers found that actors were doing it deliberately. And that's a shame. They shouldn't do it deliberately. The real bloopers were very funny. But now they don't take them out anymore. Any blooper is corrected immediately. And sometimes it's like a spoonerism. Sometimes you just transpose the word. And sometimes you say a very naughty word and you don't realize it's been caught on the microphone.
Actually, that leads me to a question that I hadn't thought of. If you are you're doing something and maybe you, I'm not sure what your process is, but if you just stop, take a moment, and then start a sentence again, if you do this or if you do it a few times and if it just bugs you, for some reason you can't get it and it's just annoying and you know you can get it, but you're just having a hard time with it?
Oh, yeah.
Do you ever...
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Do you ever just, like, say a choice word and then...
Oh, yes. I have said it. And then, of course, I've apologized profusely. And it's not so much a phrase. There was... Because I can't come up with a word now. I could not say it. I just could not say it. And I thought, this is ridiculous. And it was a word of obviously more than one or two syllables. And I kept getting the emphasis wrong. And I took a break. I finally said, look, I'm going to have to go out and walk around and calm down. Because otherwise, the next thing is you hit the word so strongly that it's going to burst your eardrums. You know, it's like, oh, anti-disestablishment areas. And there I said it. and then it leaps out of the recording, so then you have to go back and read it properly in the context of the sentence. Oh yeah, I have come out with a few choice ones, and then I have to apologize, as I say, to my poor gal across. Actually, sometimes it's a man, and then I go out and have a cup of tea and come back and try again. Yeah, it happens. It happens. One time I thought I was never going to get past it, because, and then it becomes like a fixation, and you think it's coming up, and you can't always slot the word in. Very often, of course, it always comes in the middle of a long sentence or a huge paragraph. So very often what I would do then is you could almost memorize a sentence, and you close your eyes and you just say it as it comes, and there it's gone and you're on, and there's the period. You can take a sigh of relief and carry on. And it might take as much as 2 or 3 minutes to get that one little sentence out. So, yeah, it happens. And it happens on the oddest words, too, words you've said all your life. But it will come at the end of usually the end of a long, long paragraph. And then you make a mistake in the very last line, which sometimes you can cut in and do, but very often you just do the whole paragraph again. And yes, there are a few choice words that come out, and I will not discuss those over the phone, because I think that's probably a federal offense, isn't it, to hurl obscenities down the phone.
I think you're okay on the phone. I think it's just, when you do it on the radio.
But yes, that too. Anyway, I have to protect my image. My goodness. I mean, if I have to swear, I can and I will. But not too many of my books. Usually, it's asterisks. So there is a four-letter word that is becoming more and more not so much in the UK. No, that, I shouldn't say that. In some of the more graphic police novels that I've recorded, yeah, the street talk can be pretty graphic.
Well, we like to finish interviews that we do with some questions that we call quirky questions. You may have been asked them in your life, but we hope that you have not been asked them in an interview before.
Okay.
And they're quite simple. And the first one is, what was your worst subject in high school?
Math.
Math.
Yeah.
What was your best subject in high school?
English.
Well, that's appropriate.
Yes.
If you had to eat the same meal for the rest of your life, like you couldn't eat anything else, what would it be?
Probably fresh bread, good cheese, and an apple. Or one butter. I could eat that for the rest of my life.
Sounds good. I could eat that right now. I'm kind of hungry.
Would you add a drink to that, or just?
Tea.
Tea.
English tea. And Yorkshire Gold, actually, and that's advertising, but good strong.
That's okay.
British tea, they call it.
Finally, what was your childhood nickname?
Jeannie, which is actually, I have three names. Davina is my first name, and then I was called after my Scottish great-grandmother, Elspeth, and then Jean, and so I was Jeannie growing up. And my father, bless his heart, used to call me Snookums. That did not last into adulthood. Snookums Porter just doesn't go, does it?
I know. I think Davina Snookums Porter sounds extremely professional.
I think it does indeed. I had to grow into that name, you see.
Well, Ms. Porter, it has been a joy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you indeed. So, and hopefully we'll get together after the book is published, and then we can really go through her again.
Oh, absolutely. We were going to ask you that, but we're so happy that you mentioned it first.
It's recorded now. You have to do it.
Okay.
We would really appreciate that. That would be great.
Oh, I will indeed. Okay. Thanks a lot, ladies.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
So a huge, huge thank you to Ms. Davina Porter. We had such a great time. And as she said, you heard it from her first. We're very excited to do some kind of follow-up interview once
after Moby
is released.
Definitely, I'm looking forward to it.
And also a huge shout out to Recorded Books for allowing us to include a snippet from Outlander.
So that's about it for episode 13 of the Outlander podcast. Next week we start up the read-along again. We're going with chapter 11 entitled Conversations with a Lawyer.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/OutlanderPod. Or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.
I dreamt it last night that my young love